Welcome back. Welcome back. I'm Lawrence Brown, the Dr. Lawrence Brown, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I am thrilled to be here this morning to have this tremendous, thrilling discussion with two former SNCC organizers, Betty Robinson and Judy Richardson. Betty Robinson was a community organizer who was a part of SNCC. She's lived in Baltimore for 42 years, where she's worked in the field of public health research and raised her daughters. She organizes around fair development, has worked with the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, the campaign to stop Walmart at 25th and Howard, and other union and community work. She's also the co-editor of the anthology Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC. Miss Betty Robinson, good morning.
Good morning, Lawrence. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. And we also are joined by Judy Richardson, who worked in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. She's on the production staff for the Academy Award-nominated PBS series Eyes on the Prize and was its education director. And she is also the co-editor of the anthology Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC. Good morning, Miss Judy Richardson.
Good morning, Lawrence.
So glad you're both joining us today. We want to tell our listeners, please call in with your comments, 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner or at BeMoreDoc, which is my hashtag, or excuse me, my handle. You can also comment on our Facebook page or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. So once again, good morning, Ms. Robinson and Ms. Richardson. I'm so glad that you're able to join us.
So am I.
It's our pleasure.
I'm hoping that our listeners can go on our on the Mark Steiner Show website and pull up the last discussion that we had once this podcast is entered in and collected on the website so that they can sort of hear the continuity between these discussions. The last time you were here, we talked about how you became members of SNCC, how you left the North, came to the South, or went to the South during the summer of the Freedom Summer.
Well, before that, actually, but yes.
Right, right. And so just to sort of get the background in terms of what we're going to discuss today, but I want to start off talking about Julian Bond, who did pass away this weekend. What are some of your recollections of him, and what did he mean to SNCC?
I don't know. Betty, do you want to go first?
I mean, Julian was a key person in SNCC. He was our communications director. He was the one who built relationships with the press and encouraged them to cover the events in the South. He was also very funny. Mm-hmm. And I actually, on this little internal SNCC conversation we've been having about remembering Julian, somebody unearthed a memo, which I think it would be fun to read part of it. So this was a memo called How to Be SNCC-y. And he said this information is to serve as a guide for new staff members. And then he went on to say, you know, it could also be old staff members.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just going to read a little part. He said, in addition, there are several body movements you need to commit to memory. Practice them in your room if you choose, or if you live in Atlanta, in your apartment. The Foreman Swing. Jim Foreman was the executive secretary of SNCC, and he was very demonstrative in his in making arguments or in pressing a point. So the Foreman Swing is a circular motion.
Okay.
Away from your body. Everybody do it while we're on the radio here. Circular motion away from your body of the right hand, usually, and this is where Julian's humor comes in, usually to lull the audience into a comatose state. At one time, the Foreman Swing enjoyed great popularity in SNCC until everyone started doing it, some with both hands, and it's being replaced by the Moses two-finger punch. a forward jabbing motion of the first two fingers of the right hand used to punch holes in other people's arguments. And then moving up quickly is the Casey clutch. So Casey was Casey Hayden, who was a white Southerner who was very involved in SNCC. So the Casey clutch is a quick catching motion of the thumb and index finger as if to grab a critical issue. Slightly less popular is, and he goes on to detail other things. But that's kind of a flavor of Julian's humor. He had incredible, and just to say that one of the things about movements is they need music, they need culture, and they need humor. So, And Julian was a master of the humor side.
Absolutely. I had forgotten, because I'd seen that on the SNCC list as well, but that's a funny memo. I mean, for me, I think, because I, like Betty, I was in the national office of SNCC in Atlanta with him, but also I ran the office for his first campaign for the Georgia House of Representatives. That was in 1965. And when I say I was the office staff, I was the only office staff.
I was
the office staff.
Okay.
That's right. And we were right on what is now Martin Luther King Avenue, but it was then called Hunter Avenue, and right by the Atlanta University complex.
Mm.
And it was near Pascal's.
Yes.
It was right next door to a barbershop, which is where we always had our stuff. I mean, we did not have plush offices. We were the extreme the other way. So anyway, in this office, I mean, what was wonderful is that he loved people. I mean, Julian loved people. He loved talking to them. Didn't matter who they were, where they came from. He loved talking to them, and they knew it. And so even when we were, so during the campaign, I remember the Red Rosebud Savings Club, and this was a club of older black women. They were out Gordon Road, out from the main part of black Atlanta at that point. And again, we're talking 66, and we're running his campaign, and a lot of people wanted him to come talk. But he was late from at another event,
mm-hmm.
and it's before cell phones, so I didn't know where he was, you know. So I'm scared because I know I have to go be there, but I don't know how to talk to people at that point, and it's like, oh, what am I going to say? And they're expecting Julian. Well, he ended up – I ended up finding him. And so we go out there, and he walked in, and it was like – they turned to butter. I mean, these older black women, it was like, oh, the prince has come, you know. But what was great is that he did not use his really good looks, his wonderful humor, his real persona as an excuse for doing nothing, right? He was absolutely committed all the way to the end of his life. He was strong. He was committed about not just racial inequity, but all kinds of inequities.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing LGBT stuff. He's trying to get, you know, some of the older black Baptist ministers in the NAACP board to move forward in terms of acknowledging the rights of gay people. He's doing, oh, gosh. Betty, help me out here. Where he actually got arrested most recently on an issue.
On the White House fence or protesting the Keystone Pipeline.
That's right.
So that was his last arrest. So it just shows how he was able to connect all of the movements and talk about how they're connected. And he even was really excited, of course, about the Dream Defenders and the Black Lives Matter activists. And just an anecdote from me personally, so we all had Julian's email, right? And I would sometimes want to connect him with young people in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Was he going to be at a certain event, and could I introduce him to this Baltimore Algebra Project youth or whatever? He would always email me right back telling me, yes, send them up, or no, I'm not going to be there. So he was very open and very welcoming to, and, you know, the thing about the Black Lives Matter movement and Dream Defenders is he really talked about how they reminded himself of when he was young. And, you know, I think for all of us, that's we're thinking, oh, my gosh, this is what we did when we were young, and you know, we're totally supportive of these new movements. So,
but could I just piggyback too on that, because Julian also would always, you know, you would have people, young people, high school students doing National History Day, for example. And there was one young woman, she and her partner in high school, they were doing something on Miss Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you as SNCC folk, you know, you get a lot of calls, and it's like, okay, how many of these can I do? And you know, so. I said, no, I don't know. He emailed me, and he said, you know, we need to make time for these folks. I said, I know, but, you know. Well, it turned out this young woman was amazing. I mean, she got to the finals. She got here to D.C. She was from Minnesota. But he talked to her, and he kind of nudged us to talk to her. But there was a wonderful piece most recently in The Nation magazine that's online from Jean Theo Harris, who is a professor at Brooklyn College, I think, the CUNY system in New York City. And what's wonderful is Jean did a recent book on the radical tradition of Rosa Parks. Mm. It's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did not know until I saw her piece last week at The Nation about Julian that she took a course with him, learned about him. He spent 3 days on the Montgomery bus boycott, dissecting it, but always from the ground up, which is how we understood you do things in SNCC, right? So organizing from the ground up. So he's not talking about Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy only. He's mainly talking about Joanne Robinson of the Women's Political Council. He's talking about all of the folks, E.D. Nixon, who are making that. And then she becomes his teaching assistant. So she learns even more. So she goes through it. I think the title of the piece is What I Learned from Julian Bond.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a direct through line from her being exposed to Julian and his bottom-up theory and local movement teaching to when she's writing her own book, and all of that comes out in her own work.
Now, that's where I want to take our discussion, and I just want to back up for a moment. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was founded in 1960, am I correct?
Yes, that's correct. April 15th at Shaw University in Raleigh.
Shaw University and Ella Baker.
Alma mater. Yeah.
Right. And what was the purpose behind SNCC? What did SNCC actually do, just for those who maybe didn't hear our last show?
Well, another thing that Julian wrote, which I recommend, one of the things that Jean Theo Harris talks about in the Nation article, which I recommend people go online and just type in What I Learned from Julian Bond. But Julian did in that the 2010 SNCC reunions, he did a speech called SNCC What We Did that was republished by the Monthly Review, and you can also get that online. So it talks about all of the work that SNCC did across its history. And I think it's valuable for people to really read this stuff and understand this stuff. SNCC was not just the sit-in students. It was not just the whatever you imagine SNCC to be. It was much more than that. So it came together. Miss Baker had the understanding, because she had been involved in a long tradition of movements. So she understood the need for the young people who had organized the sit-ins in their various communities. She understood the need for them to come together and have a conversation about where the movement was going, what they were thinking, moving forward to fellowship, etc. So that was why she brought SNCC together in 1960, April 15th. And so it was initially about the sit-in students, big debate about whether to put nonviolence in the name. There's lots and lots of historical discussions that you can find in the scholarship, in a book by all the books. I've got The Light of Freedom by Charles Payne, Bloody Lands by Hassan Jeffries, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, a more recent book by Charlie Cobb, Civil Rights History from the Ground Up by Emily Crosby. So, again, I'm recommending these things, and I'm not trying to divert the question, because we did evolve from an organization of the sit-in leadership to a field organization across the South doing voter registration. And I don't, Judy, want to tell the story about the debate in SNCC, or do you want me to tell the story?
Well, let me just go just Because I think you're right, Betty, that people, whatever you think was just SNCC, it was much more. Because people assume that it was just, you know, young people sitting on the counters and getting their heads beat to try and integrate all white facilities. And when we went into voter registration, it was because we understood the power of the vote. And we understood that power particularly because when Bob Moses, who becomes the head of the Mississippi Project for SNCC, when he goes into Mississippi in 61 and has the initial contact, he gets a contact because of Miss Baker and Jane Stembridge, who kind of sets it up from the Atlanta office. And he gets that contact with Amzie Moore, who is an old-line black NAACP local leader in Cleveland, Mississippi. And Amzie is a World War II veteran. When Bob talks to him, Amzie pulls out a precinct map. And this is not right in 62, but when Bob goes back again in 62, not in 61, but back in 62, and Bob pulls, Amzie pulls out this precinct map and says, look, you young people can do voter, can do sit-ins if you want to. But he says, I know that our power as black people is going to be around the right to vote. Hmm. And so he pulls out this precinct map on his kitchen table. And I heard this directly from Bob, although Bob has told this story many, many times. And this is when, we were doing Eyes on the Prize. And I said, oh, Bob, you know, I'm forgetting a lot of this stuff. He said, yeah, me too. But then he tells me this story. And he says, okay, Amzie pulls out the map, and he says, look, these are where there are major pockets of black folks. And, you know, again, when we talk about black power for SNCC in 1966, we're always talking about black power. When Amzie is talking to Bob, he's talking about how do we get power as black people that will counterweigh the white power that exists in the country at this time. Mm-hmm. So precinct map tells them where to go, and then we begin doing voter registration. But we also do alternate political organizing. So when we come up straight against the racism of the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party, mm-hmm. We then organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And because we had a really strong research department and a lot of amazing pro bono lawyers, we used everything that the Democratic National Committee said we had to do an alternate delegation. We did the precinct meetings. We tried to get into theirs. They denied us. We set up it. We dotted every I. We crossed every T. But then we were also into economic issues. We always talked about economic equity. We took over the Greenville Air Base at a time when they were throwing off sharecroppers. White people were throwing off the sharecroppers who tried to register to vote. We took over the vacant Greenville Air Base in Greenville, Mississippi. We did a lot of things that were around economic equity. We understood the African colonial struggle. So when we say, take one man, one vote, as our slogan, it's because we're looking at Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and Mandela, who's still in jail. You know, we're looking at all of these folks all over. And I remember hearing Betty. We were sitting in a Freedom House, and Betty starts talking about Nicaragua and Central America and the freedom struggles that are going on there. There was a way that many of us had a sense of the rest of the world and how our struggle connected with that.
And that's very powerful mm-hmm. to me because I want to go back to this notion that, you know, the philosophy of SNCC really was this sort of bottom-up local organizing indigenous leadership approach. And that a lot of this is happening in the time before the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is passed. So you all are doing this in a moment when voting is not secure for black Southerners, sharecroppers, domestic maids, black folk living in the South.
Even teachers and doctors and lawyers were denied, depending upon who the registrar was in their community. But there were lots of tricks and barriers that the local registrars put up to keep people who obviously had advanced education, to keep them from voting.
So I want you to contrast the work you did around voting rights then with the way that voting rights are being attacked and curbed and curtailed now. How do you see the struggle for keeping voting empowerment alive in light of the work that you did?
So there are groups around the country. I mean, one I would point to is the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina, where there's been a real attempt to roll back voting rights. There are the Dream Defenders in Florida who are working on, other things besides they worked on the Trayvon Martin case, but they've worked on voting rights as well. So the key thing is that I believe the voting rights are being rolled back because the right wing and the white people with privilege in this country are scared of black and brown people having more chance at power and voting people in, as well as playing a part in the decisions in those communities. So there are all kinds of tricks and traps that the right wing is using to deny voting rights. Remember in Florida during Al Gore's the election in whatever
2000.
Year it was, 2000, and in Georgia they wiped people off the rolls, claiming that they were convicted criminals, and it turns out they just did a broad sweep, and half the people were not at all connected to the criminal justice system. I believe that ex-offenders should be able to vote the minute they walk out of prison. But these were rules that they had about waiting a certain amount of time and that kind of thing. And so they, wiped people off. And then there's the gerrymandering, not to speak about just the voting rights rollback, but gerrymandering, you need an ID to vote. But there are movements in all of these states which are countering the rollback of voting rights and connecting it to broader anti-oppression issues, to economic issues. So it's not what I think is fabulous about today is that people are connecting the issues across the board. They're not just saying, one of the things that I've always felt is that you can't just say we want a $15. You can't just say the fight for 15 is where we're going. In other words, the fight for $15 an hour minimum wage, but you have to connect it to anti-oppression issues. You have to connect it to historical institutional racism and structural inequity. You have to connect it back to the criminal justice system. You have to look at everything and how it's connected across the board. You can't just say, well, I want voting rights to be available for everybody. That's not sufficient. It's got to be in the broader historical context of why these things are happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, I'm Lawrence Brown sitting in for Mark Steiner here in your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back. And on our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its member and its communities prosper. When you invest yourself in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meq.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Lawrence Brown sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for Cool Jazz and More. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're joined here by Betty Robinson on the phone, I should say, by Betty Robinson and Judy Richardson, both who were community organizers and activists with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and both who are also editors of the book, the anthology, Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC. And we've been reminiscing and celebrating the life of Julian Bunn and his work. I really love the segment that those producers just put together.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yes, yes. Rest in power, Julian Bunn.
Hey, can I just add, because it reminded me of one thing. When we were talking about Julian and the campaign that we ran as a SNCC political campaign in Atlanta in 65 that got him elected for the first time, much to our surprise, I think, my surprise. What was interesting is that the Georgia House, which was, overwhelmingly white, then asked him to disavow, before he took his seat, to disavow SNCC's anti-Vietnam War statement, which was a major statement coming from SNCC,
right,
as we did with, you know, anti-apartheid, as we did for a number of things. But on the anti-Vietnam War statement, the Georgia House said, you, Julian Bond, just elected overwhelmingly by your constituents, you have to disavow your this statement in order for us to allow you to take your seat. And he wouldn't do it. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
And unanimously, the Supreme Court said, you all must be kidding. Because, of course, it was a different Supreme Court.
Right.
This
yeah.
Supreme Court, who knows what they would have done. But he was staunch. If he felt that he was taking a principled position, nobody could budge him.
And
just to add to that anti-Vietnam, that the opposition to the war in Vietnam bubbled up from the grassroots, and it was something SNCC was hearing in the communities where we worked, and so then it became full blown a statement that SNCC made, but it wasn't. It didn't just come from the mind of some. I mean, in the Selma movie, for example, they depict Jim Foreman and John Lewis as these kind of distant-seeming college intellectuals. Nothing could be further from the truth. So the connection to the communities and to the local people engaged in struggle is one of the key hallmarks of SNCC's work.
Yeah, I heard a speech by Fannie Lou Hamer, who she would say, "Bring our boys home."
Mm-hmm.
And she would repeat that refrain. She gave it at Berkeley, I believe, in in the late 60s. And she was saying, "Bring our boys home."
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess historically, SNCC was the first civil rights organization to come out against the war. Isn't that correct? I mean, even before Dr. King comes out.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
And in fact, in Eyes on the Prize, the second series, which is 8 hours, which to me is even more relevant to today than the first series is. So, because it goes from 1965 with Malcolm X, with the Panthers in Chicago, the assassinations of the Panthers in Chicago. But there's a full segment on Dr. King's last life last year.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fourth hour in that 8 hour second series. And in that, we did an interview. I did the interview with Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture.
Mm-hmm.
And we show how, Stokely gets his call from Dr. King the morning of the Sunday when Dr. King is to come out initially against the war. And we make clear, SNCC had already come out against this.
Yep.
And this is
It was a position paper, correct?
I'm sorry?
There was a position paper actually put out saying, here's our position against the war. Right.
And why? Because we always were bottom. Everything we did was underpinned by research, solid research. So Stokely talks about how, you know, Dr. King calls him and says, you know, I want you to come to my church. Stokely says, well, you know, I don't know if I can make it. And then Dr. King says, I'm going to come out against the war. And this is before Dr. King's Riverside Church speech. This is when he initially does it in his own church in Atlanta.
Ebenezer,
that's right. And so the next shot after you hear Stokely talk about this is the speech, Dr. King giving it, it's footage, the archival footage from that speech in his church.
Oh, my.
And you see him saying, and I'm not going to study war no more. And you see Stokely and Cleve Sellers, who is another SNCC person who's now head of the HBCU Voorhees College in Denmark, South Carolina. But the two of them are sitting there. And as soon as he says it, you see the camera go to them and they stand up and give him a standing ovation.
That's exactly how he describes it in his autobiography, Ready for the Revolution, or Ready for Revolution. He talks about, like, Dr. King giving him that call. And there's this interesting collegiality that they had. Mm-hmm. You can see that Dr. King had this real respect for Stokely at the time, and how Stokely was really – and SNCC – was really an inspiration for Dr. King to move in that anti-war direction. And so he wanted them to be there. I thought, I read that and I was tickled black.
Tickled black. Well, the other thing was, you know, people always set up this thing between Dr. King and the SNCC folk. You know, there was a lot of admiration. You know, yeah, we didn't like the hierarchical thing of Dr. King's organization, and no, we didn't like, you know, this kind of thing of putting somebody up top, because our thing was we were just the organizers. We were not the leaders, and that we needed to develop local leadership that would survive even our deaths. Mm. So we didn't have the same organizing model. But the main thing was, King, Dr. King likes SNCC people. Prathia Hall, who becomes this major force, particularly among African-American female theologians and preachers, she, you know, she talks about going over to Dr. King's house and Reverend Abernathy's house and, you know, and eating Sunday dinner there. And, you know, a lot of SNCC people, you know, some of the SCLC people did not like SNCC folk. Mm-hmm. Y.T. Walker did not like SNCC folk. Mm-hmm. But Dr. King really did, and there was an easy camaraderie, not just with Stokely, but with other folks.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in this year, 1965, because we're here in 2015, 50 years out. Everybody was celebrating 50 years after Selma in 2014, but you don't hear a lot of celebrations about 50 years about things that were happening in 1965. We just passed the anniversary for Watts, but that wasn't really a celebration for that rebellion. but there were things still going on. I think in my reading of history, this is 1965 is when the movement begins to become more militant. The Deacons for Defense arrive on the scene after planning and experiencing so much terrorism, white supremacist terrorism on the behalf of like the Louisiana and Mississippi Klans. They organized with armed self-defense to guard and defend civil rights marchers marching that was taking place through the South. What was your sense, Betty and Judy, about what was taking place at that time when the movement begins to sort of make that more militant turn?
Well, I have a good example of, you know, Selma was in 65, so early 65,
right.
March of 65,
mm-hmm.
of course. And one of the things, SNCC didn't really totally agree with Dr. King kind of dropping into a community and mobilizing people for a mass march. So we had a kind of, a skepticism about what that march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge was going to be like. And
mm-hmm.
I think a healthy skepticism, because we see what actually transpired. But then when 2 weeks later, when Dr. King came back and led people on a long march between Selma and Montgomery, one of the things that Stokely Carmichael and Bob Mance did was they talked with people along the route. They got names and they got phone numbers of people from Lowndes County who had come out to observe this long march. And then they were able to go back after the press left and, you know, Dr. King was safely back in Atlanta. They went into Lowndes County and collected and met with people, did what we call it a one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an organizing technique, but in those days it was just they had the man or woman's phone number and name, and they would go and say they would either appear at the house if it was out in the plantation, or they would call up and say, I'd like to come and meet with you, and then they would do it, and they would have a conversation about how people were feeling about their lives, what were they thinking the solutions should be, and out of that evolved the Lowndes County. Well, Judy, you can fill in here because you're much more familiar with Lowndes County, but there was a local organization already in existence. That's the other thing, that the Selma movie really doesn't give you that understanding that in 1939, the Dallas County Voters League was formed. And Amelia Boynton, who was, you know, in all the Selma movies, she was pointed out as a stalwart, a community stalwart, but she and her husband and other people had started in 1939 to demand voting rights.
Mm.
So in Lowndes County, there was a prior organization, so Stokely and Bob Mance were able to hook up with that. And then from that built the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, which had the symbol of the Black Panther.
And this is Lowndes County, Alabama.
This is Lowndes County, Alabama, right next to Dallas County, which is where Selma is. So this is right, it starts evolving right after the Selma to Montgomery March in 65, and then it moves forward from there. So I'll let Judy fill in some more about that.
Before you go, I want to remind our callers, please join in the conversation. We want to get a couple of calls at least at 410-319-8888. Go ahead, Judy.
Yeah, no, Betty's right. And I actually went in to Lowndes with Stokely and Bob. And what was great is that Mr. Hewlett and a few others in Lowndes County had wanted to do voting rights. And they saw what was going on during the spring campaign in Selma, Alabama, next door, that wanted to do something similar. What was interesting is that a lot of times it's the World War II vets who've come back home and said, no, we just fought a war, the double freedom, all that stuff, and we're not going to take this anymore. So they had already started setting it up. And when Betty mentions the Panther, because a lot of folks, not just black folk, but white folk, because one of the things were could not read and write. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, because one of the ways that Southern white supremacy worked is that as long as you keep white folks and black folks both illiterate, mm-hmm. and you don't give them good education, mm-hmm. And you set the white folks against the black folks, mm-hmm. then we, the plantocracy, can keep in power, right? Mm. So it wasn't just black people who were illiterate at that point, but certainly this is the rural area. It's also Lowndes County had a lot of black farm owners. They owned their own land.
Right.
And so they had started this organization. The reason they used the logo of the Black Panther, and there's a whole story around that, which we won't go into. But but the reason they used it is because the logo of the just about all white Democratic Party in Alabama was mm-hmm. the white rooster,
the
and it
rooster.
Said rooster, and it said underneath the logo white supremacy for the right. And so
wow.
Yeah.
White supremacy for the right or the white?
For the right. For the right. And, I'm looking to see if I can get that exactly straight.
Okay.
But it was like, I need to really double check this. But they do say white, and I'm pretty sure it's supremacy.
Right.
And then for the right, R-I-G-H-T.
Right.
And it's the rooster. And they were, sending a clear signal out about who this party was for. Well, we use the Black Panther, and you see in the Eyes on the Prize segment on the Lowndes County, you see that Jimmy Jackson, no, not Jimmy Jackson, he was who was killed, a young black organizer who says, look, we saw the white rooster, and then we decided, oh, we're going to do the Panther, because the Panther can eat up the rooster anytime. So that was their thing. Can I just mention, too, I don't know that I would call the area, the time after 65, more militant, even in terms of self-defense. There was always local self-defense. The reason that we organized it, SNCC, CORE, SCLC, the reason we more of us were not killed is because local people had guns and used them.
Right.
They protected us. They protected us when we were going, there were SNCC and CORE folk going to try and find out where the bodies of those three particular civil rights workers were in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney.
That's correct. And they are protected. Where SNCC people are and CORE people are staying, they are protected with black people on the roofs of the houses where organizers are staying before they go out under cover of night to try and find those bodies.
Yeah.
Women, honey, Mrs. Quinn in Mississippi did not play. She had a gun. I mean, it wasn't just guys, black men who had guns.
Right.
It was black women who had guns. And there are all kinds of stories leading up to that. And I don't know that we got more militant. We just moved in a different direction after 65.
Now, there's a story in Ready for Revolution by Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, who says that he was watching a polling place and there's an older black lady who comes up to vote. And she hands him her gun and goes inside the polling place, votes for the Panther, and gets her gun back when she comes out and says, I just want to come, vote for the Panther, and go home.
Right. So So in Hands on the Freedom Plow, this is one of the first publications. That's the book that Judy and I and four other women were co-editors of, and 52 Stories of Women Who Were in SNCC. But I'm going to tell you a little anecdote from that. So Janet Moses, who's married to Bob Moses, tells a story about being in a demonstration, I think, in Hattiesburg. And there's an older black man, and he has a brown paper sack. And she's sitting next to him on a wall, and he pats the brown paper sack, and he says, "Miss Janet, I have your back." And she's like a little bit, you know, not sure what he's talking about. And so he pats the brown paper bag again, and he opens it up, and there's a gun in there.
Right.
So he's brought it to the demonstration to say, if anything goes down, I'm ready.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And again, this is taking place in a time when the Louisiana and Mississippi, Alabama Klans were very powerful and controlled city governments, state governments, oftentimes, or at least had significant influence.
And the White Citizens Council. Because
yes.
White Citizens Council.
Let us not forget the White Citizens Council.
Exactly. Because they're looking at the Klan like, oh, you know, they may do our dirty work, but they're basically lower class. We're the heads of the
respectable
banks. We're respectable heads of the banks. We own the factories in town, and we're really pulling the strings. But they're going to, you know, they're going to do the violence.
Right. We do have a caller. I'm so happy. Kadria from Baltimore, you're on the Mark Steiner Show. Welcome.
I was an 18-year-old girl in Harlem when all this was going on. I want to know if the past history is best qualified to reward all future research. What is wrong with us arming ourselves now to save our children? Number two, if we live in a Christian country...
Kadria, can you back up a little bit from the phone and repeat what you just said? I want to make sure we get it.
Okay. I said I am a 17-year-old girl. I was 17 years old in Harlem when all of this was going on.
In Harlem. Okay. Mm-hmm.
If all past research is qualified to reward all future researchers, why don't we take the hit from the past, arm ourselves, which is Constitution, which was never forced, of course, but which we say is ours, which the Constitution says we have a right to, as Huey Newton did in New York City and in California.
Mm-hmm.
You have a right to arm yourself. You have a right to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Our boys are not looking at us as men if we can't protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Three important things I learned when I was that age about a man is a producer, protector, and provider. It's a man's job to protect the whole society and the woman to support him, literally. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think our boys are looking at when one small, puny somebody can walk into a church full of people and kill nine people and nobody even have guts enough to subdue this boy, to even push him, and he wasn't even big? It shows you the state of our brain. The next thing is, if anybody's seen the Battle of Algiers, that's another thing for us to look at, because we're going to sit here passive. Passive is not going to help us. These people, just like in the Bible, for all you Christian people, this is just like Herod going to the door of everybody in the community, looking to see when that child was born. Why do you think they killed up our boys? Can they shoot a man in his groin? What does that mean? He can never have no more children. Is that a thing a humane person do? You've been dealing with sadists all our life in this country. They're not changing. The tiger cannot change his stripes. You can take it for what it's worth, but it's right before your eyes.
Kadria, thank you for your remark. You know, she mentioned, especially in the church, when in Charleston, the massacre there carried out by white supremacist terrorist Dylann Roof. What about this notion of self-defense, carrying out our constitutional Second Amendment rights to protect ourselves in the face of this sort of modern-day terrorism?
Can I just mention, I saw Battle of Algiers 5 times
mm-hmm.
when it first came out,
mm-hmm.
and I certainly am not philosophically nonviolent, but Algiers, that was their country. They were the majority. The French colonial power were brutal.
Mm-hmm.
They tortured people.
Mm-hmm.
They did everything they could to maintain their power. But they were not the majority. They were not the ones who... it was not their country. France was their country.
Right.
The problem we have always had, I think, is that it's not that we are philosophically nonviolent. It's tactical.
Right, minority.
Because the power of the state, that's the reason... When we go into Mississippi or Alabama, we may be armed. The people that we work with are armed. But you have to. If the main thing is how do you get black folks register to vote without getting them killed.
Right.
Without getting them killed.
Right.
And getting their whole community wiped out, as often happened when black people took too much control. The Black Wall Street,
right.
Rosewood, all that stuff.
Right.
How do you do it so that...
And many, many other examples. Wilmington in North Carolina,
Wilmington.
1898. There's a whole map online called Collective Punishment, where it's at least 100 examples of these, of mob violence, race riots, pogroms, coup d'etats. In my home county of Crittenden County, in Arkansas, I'm sorry.
Oh.
In 1888, there was a group of whites with Winchester rifles that escorted the three black county leaders to the Mississippi River and told them to leave, and they couldn't come back. And so, you know, this sort of, and then curbed the black vote, and then really instituted this white supremacist regime for the next, well, still, it's still in place today. You know, I think there is a real, that's a reality that we don't really often account for that. Go ahead, Judy. I'm sorry. And we're going to come to you, Gerard. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Betty may have something to add.
No, I mean, I think that Judy's right that it's about tactics, and so each community has to discuss and debate and think about what are their goals and what tactics will bring about those goals. So it's really in the hands of people who are organizing today to think through these historic questions. I know these questions have been asked since the 1800s, at least, in U.S. history. So, again, you know, I thank Kadria for her comment and her observations. And, again, it's for people who are organizing today to really think through what is it that's going to work and bring
But I would also add to that. I mean, when you talk to local organizers, for example, I was in St. Louis County during the Missouri, during the Ferguson stuff. And what was interesting is that they said, we're trying to do long-term organizing. And you've got young black guys, particularly men. And by the way, for me, it's not that the men should be the only ones protecting the community, but
I was going to address that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Because you were saying earlier that women were also protecting the community in the South as well.
Absolutely. But I would also say, you know, the problem is that if you are not mobilizing, as Betty can pick up on, what happens is that you get a momentary march, the cops come down, they arrest people, maybe they kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You have gone no further forward in terms of empowering the community. All you did was get off your anger.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it diverts the press from your long-term goals.
Exactly.
It's like idiot Trump going through his
mm-hmm.
thing. All those silly little Republican candidates can't even get some airtime because he's doing his little stupid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, you got to do the organizing. That, you know, anyway.
Wait, so no, that's an important, that's one of the things I hope our listeners do glean, especially the younger people who are engaged in these movements and may not have a sense of the history. You're saying that marching without organizing is ineffective? I want you to flesh that out. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah. That is what I'm saying, but I'll let Betty go.
Well,
yes, that is exactly what I'm saying.
A march is great. It's an expression of people's concern, anger, and demands, but there has to be organizing in between marches where the political education is done, where the community talks about what it wants, and then figures out how to get what it wants, who to target, who is the person that can make happen what needs to happen. Is it the mayor? Is it the legislature? Is it the nonprofit industrial complex? Who are the targets? And it's not just one, of course, but what does the community want? And then think about how to organize for that. And a march is simply a tactic, or you know, going to meet with a city council person or a mayor or whatever is another. It's a tactic on the way to achieving what you are demanding.
Now,
could I just mention one thing? I did find out the exact quote. I was correct on the Alabama Democratic Party at
mm-hmm.
that time
mm-hmm.
was, in fact, white supremacy for the right.
Okay.
That was above and below the white rooster that
right.
was their logo. Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the last thing as we're closed, as our time comes to an end.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, I know. you know, I'm wondering about, you know, we're in this moment where there are a lot of questions about the Democratic Party for Black Lives Matter activists. You know, there's been we interrupted and cajoled Martin O'Malley at his announcement here in Baltimore. There have been multiple Bernie Sanders interruptions by Black Lives Matter activists. Are we in a moment that you think we ought to be considering alternative political party organizing?
Absolutely. I mean, to me, that's always been a question. There's always been this tension between if we leave the Democratic Party, how will we, you know, because there are all kinds of rules and laws that mitigate, that stand in the way of a third party. But that's another question that I'm sure people are discussing and debating, you know. I wanted to recommend to people yesterday on Democracy Now, there were two Black Lives Matter members from Boston mm-hmm. who met with Hillary Clinton in
right.
New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fabulous discussion because they did the research. So they mm-hmm. unearthed all of Hillary Clinton's stands on the criminal industrial,
the crime bill, omnibus crime bill of 1994.
The crime bill, the mass incarceration mm-hmm. and so on. And they confronted her with that.
Mm-hmm.
And they taped the conversation mm-hmm. with her knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's played out. And so they talk about not only the research, but the demands. And then somebody says, well, how come why are you putting Hillary up against the wall or Bernie Sanders up against the wall? And they say, look, you start with the people who are closest to you to move them to a different position. You don't start with Donald Trump, who you know that you're not going to be able to move. So a lot of this is very thoughtful, tactical, strategic organizing, and I think it's fabulous.
And, Judy, we have about a minute to go. Any last thoughts from you?
I would just say that you can't give up on the electoral process. That we always understood that the vote was necessary but not sufficient, that if you put somebody in, you got to keep their feet to the fire. And I would also say that I think you got to do both. You got to be inside and outside. So you got to pressure the Democratic Party and then, you know, possibly do the alternate position so that there's some pressure on the Democratic Party as well.
Thank you so much. Once again,
we have to go.
I'm so sorry.
Another time.
Yes, I hope we can bring you back once again. I'm so elated always to have this discussion with the both of you, Betty Robinson and Judy Richardson. I'm Lawrence Brown, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more. We AA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back. When we come back, we'll have a brand new episode of Sound Bites. Thank you once again to our guests for this fabulous discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lawrence, for inviting us.
Absolutely.